Hello and welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and I'm delighted that our guest author today is one of my favorite writers in the world, Kristen Higgins, who's here with us to talk about her new book, Pack Up the Moon. But before I begin grilling Kristen about her past, present, and future, I do need to take a brief moment to let you know that we do have a few copies signed by Kristen herself of her new book. And I would encourage you, if you're listening in and discover that your reading life will be richer and fuller with a copy, and I know it will, to go ahead and go online to the Poison Pen or give us a call. And while we have copies, we would be happy to send one out to you. Now, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Kristen Higgins back to the Poison Pen.
Hi, John. It's so nice to see you. And hi, Poison Pen patrons. We're just about to stand with my dog here. Oh, yes, he can't sit without mommy.
Oh.
Say hello to the nice people.
Uber. Oh, how cute. That should up the audience attendance. Okay, let's go ahead and start. Let's talk a little bit about you before you were a writer. Okay. What was your life like? You were quoted as saying that you weren't really a writer. Your roots began as a reader, and then you turned into a writer.
Yeah, so. I never planned on being a writer. You know, I don't know that it's something you can really plan a career for. You know, I'd like to be an author and make a living, right? You can always write, but being a published author is different. And so I never planned on it, but I always loved reading. And I mean, I read from the time I was four on. And I worked in advertising. So I was a writer out of college. And I was also an English major, which just let me read all the books I wanted to, pretty much. And then I had my children and I didn't work for a while, a few years. And I just thought, you know, this is so great. I love being home with the kids and you know, I would like to continue to find a way to stay home. And working from home back in the olden days wasn't that common. So, you know, the pandemic has really changed that. And I mean, we barely had internet back in the old days. So, I thought, maybe I could write a book. I have read thousands of books. So, you know, maybe I can write one. And I chose to write romantic comedy because I thought that everybody likes that. And I could probably sell a romantic comedy. I did not expect to have a career as an author. You know, it's going on 20 years now, and which is just astonishing to me. I've been published for 15, and so I started writing when my son was in nursery school, and figured if I can sell a book by the time he's in first grade in all day school, you know, I won't become a bartender or, you know, I don't know what else, a cleaning lady. Those are my skills.
Now, what was it like getting your first book published? Did it take a lot of work? Were you one of those lucky people who just happened to be at the right place at the right time?
Both, really, John. I was lucky in that I sold my first manuscript, but it was a lot of hard work. One of the things that I knew from my days in marketing and advertising was if I was going to sell my first book, it would have to be as good as possible, as good as the best, as Susan Elizabeth Phillips and Jenny Cruzzi. And so I wrote the first draft in 6 months and I revised it for another year. And I was, you know, I was working part-time, but I really wanted it to be polished when I sent it out. So I did get an agent and I was also rejected by, I think, 29 agents. And I have my original agent still. And every publisher out there rejected me except for Harlequin. So, you know, I wasn't sure that this was going to work out. But once I did get published, I got this kind of sleeper following. You know, my first book was a sleeper hit in that, you know, I don't know how many copies they printed, not that many, but they all sold. And we went into a second printing. And there was just this groundswell from readers, which is really the only way an author can become a best-selling author, is that people love your book and they tell their friends and they talk about it and they say to their book clubs, we have to read this book. So that happened with me, and it's, you know, it's been an amazing and wonderful and surprising career.
Well, let's take a few minutes and talk about your new book that brought you here, Pack Up the Moon. What can you tell us about that book?
Well, this is, I feel like I've been waiting to write this book because this book holds no punches. It is a beautiful love story. It is a tragic love story, and it has a very wonderful and uplifting ending. I wanted to write a story, a tragic story. You know, I think that it was just time in a way to write about a beautiful love lost and then the recovery from that. You know, the husband is left behind, and how is he going to get to a place where the future seems possible, let alone happy, you know? So Lauren, who loves Joshua so much and knows that he's going to struggle so much, writes him a series of letters, one delivered each month with a task in it to push him out into the world and to kind of get him out of his own way. And the tasks kind of grow in import and difficulty as the time goes on. And so she walks beside him that first year of his widowhood, even though she's the cause of his widowhood.
Now, the title comes from a poem. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That poem is Funeral Blues by W.H. Auden. And it starts, "Stop all the clocks, keep the dogs from barking." And a lot of people will know it from Four Weddings and a Funeral. Yeah. Which made it a very famous and popular poem. And it's really beautiful. The sentiment is, you know, time has to stop because my beloved is no longer here. The world cannot keep going as it was because I'm so lost. And that particular line, pack up the moon, dismantle the stars. It's like even the universe has to stop because my darling is gone. And it was so powerful and so poetic. It's a that I just loved it as the title. And Auden fans will recognize it immediately.
I remember when the movie came out, this was right a little bit before the internet was really up and going, and people loved that poem so much. They were calling the library where I worked, and we had to like create a separate little fugitive fact so we could tell people, because, you know, after about the third call, we had to run and look through all the English lit books. Here, let's make it easy. Yeah, definitely. I like that you used it for a title because it does speak about the fact that the world does stop, but the world also has to go on.
Right. And Joshua references the poem sort of obliquely where he says, you know, at some point the clocks start ticking again. And the world goes on, and there comes that day when nobody calls to check on you and see how you're doing, and they're busy with their lives and you're alone, you know. And, you know, this book is, I think, a very intimate portrait of grief, in that we follow Josh right from his wife's death through the next 12 months and of change. And that was really beautiful for me to write, because grieving is love, right? You don't grieve someone you don't love. And he and Lauren loved each other so much. I guess the question is, how do you get over that? And also the other question is, when you're diagnosed with a terminal disease, as Lauren is at the age of 26, how do you live the rest of your life? What are you going to do with that? And, you know, it's very easy, I think, to slip into, I just want to try to get better. I want to find a miracle cure. I'll try all the experimental drugs. And your life can slip by while you're, excuse me, while you're trying to find a cure. And Lauren makes a very conscious decision that she wants to focus on her life more than her impending death. It's not an easy or quick decision, but that is the decision she comes to.
You kind of reference several times in the book a particular movie that is kind of her mantra, Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
A little bit about that.
Yeah, where the character of Red, who's played by Morgan Freeman, says, get busy living or get busy dying. And I love the book Shawshank Redemption, or the novella. I love the movie. And I love that line because, you know, it's applicable for so many situations where we tend to stop and navel gaze and wallow. And, you know, grief is different from wallowing, of course. You have to grieve. But Lauren decides, you know, I have a limited time here, much less time than I thought. So let's make the most of it. And for her also, and let me get Josh ready for life without me. Let me plan for the future that doesn't have me in it.
And Lauren had a particular way of kind of pushing Josh back into the world through a series of letters that gave him tasks. Tell us a little bit about that and how you decided to come up with that.
Well, Josh is on the spectrum. He works for himself. He's a super genius, very successful. He could spend the rest of his life in their apartment, you know, and that's how he was before they started dating and got engaged and married. She brings him to life with their relationship. She shows him this other world. It's almost like when Dorothy comes out of the house and she's in Oz and the world is full of color. And when she dies, she knows that he'll go back to that black and white world of solitary work and not really taking good care of himself. So she plans for this, and her first task for him is very easy. And he's so happy to hear from her. He didn't know about these letters. And so it's like he's hearing from her again. The first task is go to the grocery store. And he's so delighted because it's like she's sitting there with him. She knows he hasn't thrown away the vegetables. She knows the milk has gone rancid. And he's so psyched. And then he gets to the supermarket and he realizes he's shopping for two still. And that kind of stops him in his tracks. And then he runs into their favorite staffer at the supermarket. And she doesn't know that Lauren has died. And he has to tell her. And this is the first time he's encountered someone who doesn't know. So it's a small task, but it turns into something bigger. And each of the tasks is set out to do that, you know, to push him into the world, get him to connect to someone, just get him back into the mainstream of life, you know?
It is a very moving book about grief. And what I also liked about the book was how Josh is experiencing grief, the hero, and he seems to think that he's the only one. And you kind of show him that the death of a person affects not just that person, but a whole circle of people, like her best friend and mm-hmm. her relatives and things like that. So did you decide to do that purposely? How did you bring that into the story?
I think that came very organically in that, of course, her sister will suffer. Of course, her mother will mourn her. Of course, her sister, her best friend will be lonely. And the thing is, Josh, it's not that he doesn't expect it. He doesn't know how to handle it. You know, Lauren was the one who would tell him these things, you know, you should hug her now. You should, you know, say that you're sorry. And Josh is terrible at reading social cues. And so he very awkwardly has to negotiate this himself. And there's some humor in that too, you know, like, okay, now it's hug time. And, you know, this sort of awkward.
Mm-hmm. How long do you hug someone? Yeah.
Check that box and move on, you know. But, you know, like Lauren, and this was a very deliberate choice, I lost my dad at about the same age Lauren lost hers. So Lauren is experienced with grief in some respects, and in some ways her dad's death has taught her to live more fully. So she's a little bit better prepared than the average 25-year-old who gets a terminal diagnosis, in that she knows what she wished she had said to her dad, the things that you know could have filled his last days if only they had known. And so so I think she's got a more mature, wiser take on this diagnosis. And again, it doesn't comfort. She goes through the whole anger, denial, this isn't going to happen to me, I will become a vegan and evade the terminal diagnosis, you know.
The structure of the book is a little bit different for you too. It's two stories, it's two kind of parallel tracks, but one going forward, one looking back. Can you talk a little bit about that structure and how did it come to you to write the book that way?
Well, I knew before I wrote a word that I would tell Lauren's story backwards, mm-hmm. and Joshua's story forward. So the book starts with her death. There's no surprise about, you know, is Lauren going to make it? She is not, readers. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to tell her story in reverse, because as she goes backwards in time, for one, it's really interesting, you know, to know the ending before you know the beginning. And for two, her story ends at this beautiful moment in her life. It's the day she re-meets Joshua Park and realizes this guy is something special and we have a connection. And I think I've just met the man I'm going to marry. So her story ends at this beautiful moment of hope and promise in the future. And Joshua, going through this year, his story also ends at that kind of moment of promise and hope and, you know, the feeling that he can get through this, he can go on, and that, you know, loving Lauren and being Lauren's husband was one of the greatest things that ever happened to him, not a tragedy. So the book ends on a very uplifting and positive note, I think. And really, it's a book about hope and love and determination and caring for the people around you.
I think sometimes, I know someone who loves your books and she was hesitant because she didn't want to read something sad. And you kind of have to, sometimes as a reader, take yourself out of your comfort zone. But mm-hmm. Pack Up the Moon does deal with very powerful themes, very seriously. But there's also your trademark humor in the book. And it does have moments of hope and happiness too. So it's not just a total, you know.
It's not a love story. You know, where, mm-hmm. You know, it's not Fault in Our Stars. I wanted it to be, as my son used to say when he was a little boy, a tear dripper. because the tears would drip off his face. So I wanted it to give the reader that kind of release of being able to cry over a fictional character. But I cannot write a book that's not funny. And so there's a lot of black humor in it. There's a lot of absurd humor in it. Just like in all my books, that Joshua decides that he will take karate. That was one of my favorite scenes to write. You know, he has a miserable dinner party that is pretty hilarious. There's a lot of humor woven through it, even in the little comments. Like, you know, when he's at his wife's funeral, a woman gives him her phone number. She's coming on to him at his funeral, and he throws the piece of paper under the table, and then he's thinking like, oh my gosh, you know, someone's gonna have to pick that up, and they're just gonna think like, what, you know, what callous, horrible people they littered on the floor, they couldn't just throw. So he's obsessed with this, like, I don't want to leave that for someone else to pick up. And you know, I think all those very natural thoughts we have when we're in a moment that's dark, there's got to be something that that lifts you up. And for my readers, I didn't want to just break their hearts. You know, I wanted to put them back together. And like Joshua, to be better for having read this story. One of my readers said, this book changed me. And actually a couple of them have said that. And it was such an honor to hear that, you know, that it changes the way you think about life for the better, and that you're filled with hope and optimism, not in a naive way, but in a way of someone who has gone through something, as we as a planet have gone through something, you know. And I think this is the perfect book to read now, because it just sort of gives you that release of emotion after the year and a half we've all had, after the losses we've all sustained, and have a good cry and have a good laugh and close the book and say, that was great. I'm glad I read it.
It's very true. You kind of have a reputation though as a writer for being willing to take on, I guess we'll call them difficult subjects, like infidelity and body acceptance and mm-hmm. things like that. Does your editor ever just tell you, can't you just write a happy book for once?
She doesn't. She loves the torment that I give my characters. But yeah, I don't, you know, novels have to be difficult situations, because writing about happiness is boring. And, you know, if you write a story of a happy couple who, you know, really loves each other and they have healthy children and nothing bad ever happens to them, you wouldn't have a book. But I also have this feeling, this personal feeling, that I like to write stories about people that we might turn away from in real life, because it's too difficult to look at their lives. You know, in Good Luck With That, I had written a woman who dies because of, you know, her, what the medical term is, super morbid obesity. And, you know, I thought she deserves a story too, even though her story ends sadly. In Life and Other Inconveniences, I wrote about a woman who had lost a child. And in this book, you know, a widower. So I like to delve into those little corners that we as Americans, I think, we're sort of nationally optimistic and we don't like suffering, so we kind of pretend it doesn't exist. You know, my mom is a champion of this. If you said, like, you know, mom, I have stage 4 cancer, she'd be like, well, I knew somebody who had stage 4 cancer and they just went to Paris, Kristen, so don't worry about it. You know, she just like can't get into the down and dirty. And you know, a young woman with a terminal illness is very hard for people to deal with. You know, they think like, well, you know, the Lauren has this running joke through the book of a knee jerk response. It's like, oh, well, we're all dying. You know, I could get hit by a bus crossing the street, which is true. And it happens to people. But it's our way of saying like, well, your situation is okay because we're all mortal, right? So, you know, pat you on the head and keep going about my day. So I like to kind of explore those things that we might not want to look at and give them a soul and a personality and a person to embody them so that we can understand that better and be more compassionate about it. You know, I think everybody has a novel worthy life. John, I know I've said this to you before, that everybody has that time in their life where, yes, you could write a book about it. And I kind of pride myself on doing that for as many people as possible, not just like the beautiful youth of the world.
One of the other signature elements is you usually have a four-legged character in your books, and you do in Pack Up the Moon. Talk a little bit about that, and what as an author do you feel pets bring to a story, and what do they bring to your own life?
Well, I've never not had a pet. And I didn't consciously say, you know, it would be great and really cute for book covers as a dog or a cat. I just wrote in my first book, I wrote a dog because I had a dog. That was my dog at the time. I think that It says a lot about a person, the kind of dog that they have, how they acquired the dog. You know, did you wait for the breeder to get you the perfect golden retriever? And if so, why? You know, did you go to the pound and rescue the worst looking dog you could find? Do you have seven cats? You know, do you have a parakeet? I think it reveals something about your personality. So in my books, I choose very carefully the kind of pet that I'll have, what it says about the couple in this story. They adopt Pebbles as a puppy, and Lauren knows this dog is probably going to outlive her. And she's a very sweet and spoiled dog, and she's a great comfort to Lauren as she gets sicker, you know. And I'm saying this like with my dog at my side, speaking of snuggly puppies. So I do like to include them. I honestly don't know a lot of people who don't have pets. So I think it's a very natural element to incorporate into a story.
Let's take a little bit broader look at your writing process in general. When you're starting books, are you the kind of writer that knows exactly what you want to do? Is it a kind of a journey into darkness? Talk about your writing process.
Well, I've written 21 books now. This is my 21st. And two of them were quick and easy. And the rest of them have been difficult to write in that I might have an idea, but the idea takes some time to come to life. I like to outline. So I'll have like a one line idea for this book. I got the idea for this book when I was actually taking Luther here for a walk. We were on the beach in Cape Cod and it was winter. It was freezing cold. We were the only ones out there like fools. And I was like clutching my parka around me and saying, "Hurry up, Luther, let's go." And he had his little coat on too. And so we were hurrying back to the car and we saw this guy at the edge of the water, maybe 100 yards away. And he seemed oblivious to the weather. There was this biting wind, his hair was ruffling, and he was just staring out at the ocean. And I thought, he looks like the loneliest man I've ever seen. And I immediately thought, and I will write his story. That was the seed for Pack Up the Moon. And there is a scene where Joshua goes to the ocean in the winter. So sometimes it's just like a little drop like that, just a little seed. I didn't think I'll write a widower and they'll live in Providence, Rhode Island, and you know, she'll be this and he'll be that. It takes a while for that to come to life. So I generally start with an idea, and then I find that my book has like a theme or a subject matter. In this one, it's, I would say it's grieving, but it's also opening up, like blooming, you know? The book I'm writing now is about motherhood in many different forms. You know, Life and Other Inconveniences was about redemption. Always the Last to Know was about marriage. So once I find that, I start to amplify those storylines. I think, oh, okay, so I need to blow this up a bit and give this a bit more play in life. I do like to outline. So once I have a pretty solid idea, you know, this will be a book about two sisters and their mom, then I start to try to get to know the characters. And then where will the book open? What is the opening event that shakes everything up, that changes life so that they have to, you know, go on this journey and go outside of their comfort zone? About 200 pages into the book, my outline is irrelevant and very different. You know, I thought it was going in this direction, but in fact, it's going in a completely different one. But it's only because I've been able to spend that time with the characters and with their stories that I can veer off the map, as it were. It's a messy process, to be honest. I really envy the writers who say, you know, oh no, I just sit down and it flows from my fingertips and, you know, and I'm done 3 weeks later. And
yes. I get some of that. I think sometimes readers don't realize that people who write contemporary novels like you also have to do research, not yeah. just historical novelists and things like that. What kinds of research was involved in Pack Up the Moon? And how did you go about doing that research?
So the big research piece, John, was idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is the disease that Lauren has, for which there is currently no cure. There is treatment. And so I had to learn about that. And I actually found a young woman who has it, and she was a wonderful resource. I dedicated the book to her. And she gave me so much insight into what it's like to live with a lung problem. You know, that you have to say, like, how thirsty am I that I could walk to the kitchen and get a glass of water? Is it worth the effort? Can I go up the stairs today? If my niece comes over, you know, I need to take a nap before, probably after. And the kind of the realities of managing your life with a terminal illness. So she was wonderful. And she was also very wryly funny, and definitely someone who is grabbing every opportunity that comes her way. When I first wrote to her to say, like, would you be willing to give me some insight? She said, I would love to, but I'm in Hawaii right now. She's from Canada. And she's like, I've always wanted to swim with dolphins and I'm going to go snorkeling tomorrow. So when I get back, I will relook at this email. So she was fantastic. Everything that is in the book is researched from Joshua as a medical device engineer. So I had to look at the degrees one might get, the kind of things that need to be invented that are realistic to invent that might sell for $10 million the patent process. I researched, what it's like to live in Providence, Rhode Island, which is not far from my house. And I spent a year there in my freshman year of college. I went to Providence College. So I visited the college and picked out where they would live and walked the streets, and because I really like the reader to feel like they're there in my book so they can imagine what Providence is like, what Hawaii is like when they go on their honeymoon. Cape Cod, they spend a summer at Cape Cod, which is a near and dear place to me. So everything is researched, how long it takes to drive from here to there, you know. It's a lot easier than historical research because I don't have to talk about a time in which I did not live, right? But it is very thoroughly researched as well. And I love that part of writing.
Let's take a little bit of a segue. You're not just a best-selling author. You're also kind of a social media sensation with your own podcast. Talk to us a little bit about Crappy Friends, how it came about, what it is, why you're doing it.
Sure. So I have always had a lot of friends. I'm very extroverted and eager to make new friends. And I had a bad friend experience probably 15 years ago where I was dumped by a friend and it was shocking to me, where I thought, like, but I'm so nice, and, you know, and what did I do? It must be my fault. And I just tortured myself over this friendship breakup. And I finally admitted it to another friend, Joss Day, and she had also experienced this kind of breakup. And she said it was worse than a romantic breakup because you don't expect female friendships to fall apart. The mythology is, you know, we are friends to the grave, sister from another mister, you know, and you know, whether you're teenage girls or 80-year-olds, there is this idea that everything is supposed to be wonderful when you're together with your friends, especially for women. And so Joss and I started the podcast at my kitchen table, and we talked about our friendship experience, that brought us even closer to kind of admit that we had a bad friendship that we either had to step away from or in which someone stepped away from us. And we opened it up to letters, and it seems to be a universal experience for women, that someone you thought would be holding your hand as you drew your last breath ditches you and you didn't see it coming. So it's a very painful thing, but it's also a very common thing. And I think what it's done is let people know you're not alone in this. It's very common. And also kind of, we talk about being a good friend and what that looks like, and like good friendship habits, and also how to look for red flags. So you don't walk into a friendship with someone who has, you know, difficult person written all over them. And it's a lot of fun. It's a very, you know, organic thing. Joss and I do. We did self-published the book version of that, and have just gotten a great response from our listeners. And oh, there it is. And that's my daughter on the cover. Ah. She works for cheap.
having done this podcast and continuing to do it, what do you think is the most important quality a person should have to be a good friend? What is something they should work on or have or acquire?
I would say that communication is probably the most important thing in a friendship and in a relationship. That if something has happened that rubbed you the wrong way, or your feelings have been hurt, or you want to know why you weren't included, ask, talk. And you need to be a good friend to have a good friend. I think that's very important, that you need to reach out and listen and make opportunities for you to spend time together. Even if it might not be comfortable, even if you're that introverted one who would, you know, spend 2 weeks at home alone, not speaking to anybody, and be just fine with that, which, you know, Joss is. So I do like the fact that it's made Joss and me really look at the qualities of friendship. And I think I've become a better friend because of the podcast and because of our letters, and looking at the times that we dropped the ball or could have done better.
And anyone can tune into this? How do they?
Free, you know, go to Apple Podcasts and look for Crappy Friends, and there we are.
There are so many things I do like about you as a person and a writer, but one of them is that you're also a reader. And I love when you talk about books because you have this enthusiasm that you want to share with other readers. So are there any things, any books that you've read that you'd like to share with readers? What's on your summer reading list?
Well, right now, just before the podcast, I was reading Pretty Little Wife by Darby Kane.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a suspense story about a marriage gone wrong. And it's really tautly written. And I probably will finish it tonight because I can't stand not knowing what happened. So I love that kind of domestic noir, like The Husband's Secret or Big Little Lies. One of the greatest books I've read this year is Where the Crawdads Sing. I actually listened to that book and it was really beautifully narrated. Up next, I have When Stars Collide by Susan Elizabeth Phillips, which is maybe her 20th book about the Chicago Stars, the football franchise that she writes about. I love her writing. She's so delightful and queen of dialogue and humor. I loved The Girl with Stars in Her Eyes, which was like another book that had a lot of buzz about it. Zio Axelrod is the author. And it's about a girl poised on the precipice of big success with this new band. I'm not musical. I don't know the music scene. I was so captivated by this book. I felt like I was right there in the club listening to the smoky voiced heroine, and it's set in Philadelphia, which is a city I love. And I'm also about to start Incense and Sensibility by Sonali Dave. And I love, she's doing a Pride and Prejudice riff in Indian American culture in contemporary times. So it's, she's such a beautiful writer. Her prose is so lyrical and poetic, and talk about a sensory experience. You know, you can smell the spices, you can feel the clothing, you can smell the jasmine on the wind. You know, it's just such a great experience to read a book by Sonali. So that's about it. And I, you know, I also will veer off and listen to like a medical memoir or something kind of dark. You know, I listened to a lot of memoirs about people with terminal illnesses this past year, and they're really beautiful. And most of them are really uplifting. When breath becomes air and unwinding of a miracle, they're just gorgeous books.
How do you find what you want to read? Do you have friends that recommend them? Do you look at review sources?
I do. I love Booklist and Bookpage. And I go into my local library. I get sent a lot of books, you know, because I'm an author who might promote another author. And, you know, I like to think I'm generous that way. So publishers send me a lot of books. So I get books before they're released, which is a perk of our jobs, John. That being said, I can't go into a bookstore and not leave with an armful of books. You know, they're just seductive and worth every penny, you know.
My last question before we take a few questions from your many fans is, if you could go back in time when you were just starting out as a writer, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
I love that question. I think I would say, don't worry about what you can't control. You know, you can't, in the beginning, you can't control your covers or your release dates or, you know, how many copies are printed or which bookstores carry you or don't. That's out of your hands. Your job is to just write the best book you can in the time that you had and just focus on that and, you know, let the other people do their job, including the readers. You know, the readers have to read you. And just be good to your readers and your fellow writers. You know, being kind and generous never hurt anybody.
We do have a few questions. Your first one from a reader fan is, do you have a favorite character from all of your books?
Well, right now, my favorite character is Joshua, because I gave him such a difficult task and he rose to it so beautifully. It's always the way when your new book comes out, it's really your favorite because it's like, you know, it's like when the nurse puts the newborn baby in your arms and you're like, look what I did, you know. They're not a teenager. But I also, you know, there's a lot of characters that stand out to me as characters that were really fun to write. Genevieve from Life and Other Inconveniences. Sometimes the secondary characters. I loved Elena from Just One of the Guys, who was the sister-in-law and best friend of the heroine. I loved Max from If You Only Knew, who was the assistant in the wedding dress boutique. So, you know, there's a lot of characters that I feel like are my friends in my books. And it's so nice to go revisit them. I don't reread my books. Someday, maybe when I'm retired, I'll go back and read them all. But every once in a while, I'll open a book and say, oh yeah, I forgot about them. I love them, you know. So, this whole community I've made in my head.
The next question is about character names. Do you have a particular process when it comes to naming your characters?
For the main characters, I usually do that on my own. So I usually pick a name that I myself like, a name that fits the age of the character, you know, so I don't have like a 50-year-old Braxton, for example. I really try to name the main characters myself. Then I ask my readers on Facebook, is it all right if I use your name in a book? Because I've run out of names and it always tickles people to come across their own name in a book. So that's really helpful. I was writing today and I was like, I need a name. And I my mind goes blank and I cannot think of one name except name that I've already used in the book. I had like three characters named Kara in the most recent book. I'm like, I was highlighting them in the text. Like, think of something else. I can't, I'm frozen. So I go online and grab a name from there.
The next question is, writing is a very creative process and can be somewhat draining. Do you have a particular way or method or activities that help you refill your creative well?
When I'm done with a book and I've passed it into my editor, I am so relieved. It's her problem now, you know, and I have a few weeks where she's not going to get back to me, and I read a book, I can read two books a day. And it's just this little time period between finishing the book and revising the book. And I just try to read as much as I can. And I read every day, but I don't get to read, you know, a book a day. I read, you know, 20, 50, 100 pages a day. But in that interim, that's what really fills me up, is reading someone else's work and saying, like, that was gorgeous, or that was so interesting. It just kind of reminds you why you write books, because you love books, you know?
Looks like our last question is, because the pandemic changed the way authors and publishers and readers interacted, primarily, I guess, through everything's virtual now, or pretty much virtual, are you looking forward to doing live events with readers again at some point in time?
So much, especially at Poisoned Pen. I gotta say, John puts on the best events. I do miss it. It's very bittersweet this year. My daughter got married last weekend, so this year it was nice not to have to pack a bag and go on tour for a few weeks. But I love traveling. I love airports. And when you walk into a room that's filled with people who came to see you, it's such a rush and such a privilege that people could be home watching Jeopardy or, you know, Netflixing, you know, whatever, reading at home, but they came out to see you, and it's incredible. I mean, I will never get over that thrill and that joy. And I do, you know, I do kind of love the energy of interacting with people face to face, and, you know, hearing them laugh or seeing them react. So yeah, I can't wait.
And you did mention that you're working on another book. Mm-hmm. Is that just at the beginning process? Do you have any?
It should be finished by now, but given that I did have a wedding to plan, my publisher graciously gave me a few more months. This is a story. I mentioned the story about a story of motherhood, and it's the story of two sisters who grew up on Cape Cod, which is one of my favorite places. And they were raised in different households, though. When their parents divorced, each girl was given a choice of which parent to go to, and one picked the mom and one picked the dad. And the story opens with Lily, her son is going to college. He's her only child. And her husband tells her he's been having an affair for some time and he will be leaving her when their son goes off to college. So her world is rocked to the core. And for the first time, she'll be alone. Her other sister, Hannah, is never married, never had a serious relationship since college, and is kind of resigned to the life that she has, which is very rich and full, but not the life that she expected to have. And then she finds out something about her past that comes as a surprise. So the sisters kind of have to deal with their own things and also start to connect again. I think that's something that I really like to write, is people in the same family who have very different experiences of that family. I find it really interesting.
We look forward to that next summer. Is that the plan?
Yeah, hopefully in person.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. I want to thank Kristen, not only for talking with us today, but also for writing such a terrific book, Pack Up the Moon. It really is a book, as she said, that will change your life when you read it. Thank you again. This is the Poisoned Pen Bookstore. If you're interested in a copy, give us a call, go online, and we look forward to seeing you at another virtual event. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great night. And thank you, John.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.